Speaking of Faith is supported by the Pew Charitable Trusts. Investing in ideas, returning results. PewTrust.com. Additional support is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the John Templeton Foundation.
This is Speaking of Faith, conversation about belief, meaning, ethics, and ideas. I'm Krista Tippett. Today, science and hope with South African Quaker cosmologist George Ellis. George Ellis straddles several worlds. He's had a prolific career as a writer and lecturer on issues of time, space, and relativity. In apartheid-era South Africa, he also established himself as a social activist and a scathing critic of the nationalist regime. In recent years, he's developed a theory that there are deep ethical truths built into the physical universe. I wanted to hear how George Ellis brings his convictions about faith, ethics, and cosmology together. He was captured in his youth by the field of cosmology, the study of the origins and evolution of the universe. Here's how our conversation unfolded before a live audience at the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. The origin and evolution of the universe is quite a daunting idea. In fact, it strikes me right away, and I know you weren't working on religion and science for a long time explicitly in the same way you are now, but it seems to me that some of the same impulses, you know, some of the same questions of religion would be questions of cosmology, sort of where did we come from? And was that at all consciously a part of what interested you?
Well, very explicitly, I got involved in a lot of very technical work about the question of whether the universe had a beginning or not. And that's one of the big questions about the universe from a physical viewpoint. It's related to theological questions, but not in a simple way. And in fact, it's an error some people sometimes make. In fact, many famous people have made it to think that, roughly speaking, if the universe had a beginning, this shows there was a God who started
it.
But way back to St. Augustine, it was known, this is actually incorrect, that whether there's a start to the universe or not, the basic questions of existence remain, why the universe is what it is and what underpins its existence. So that's actually quite independent of whether it had a start or not.
In your 30s, I think, in the 1970s, you studied at several distinguished institutions in other countries. You were in the United States, in Italy, in Germany. And you wrote this book that I think has a wonderful title, The Large-Scale Structure of Space-Time, in 1973 with Stephen Hawking. You come back to South Africa, and in 1977 you publish a book on the squatter problem in South Africa.
Yeah.
And then in 1979 on low-income housing policy in South Africa. How did you get from space-time to low-income housing and then, more interestingly, perhaps, are the two related in your mind?
This is where I give a plug for applied mathematics.
Okay.
The link is mathematics because I came back to South Africa as professor of applied maths and head of the Department of Applied Mathematics. And this meant I had to look at applied mathematics in a much broader framework than just theoretical physics. And maths can be applied to study populations of fishes, economics, you name it, almost anything where there are quantities involved, there's a mathematical model. And I had been intrigued in Cambridge by the Club of Rome studies. Now, I don't know if you know the Club of Rome studies, the limits to growth. It was one of the really first studies on the way that we cannot keep using our resources at an exponentially growing rate. There's going to be a ceiling. So when I got back to Cape Town, I gave an inaugural lecture, and I talked about these models. And so someone came up to me afterwards and said, look, I'm working on housing problems. Why don't you use some of that maths to look at housing problems? So I said, okay, why not? And the point about that was, in the apartheid years, the government was a very strange mixture. It was doing these inhuman things to people, but it wanted to believe it wasn't treating people badly. There was this kind of internal contradiction all the time. And so they were destroying people's houses, taking away their livelihoods in one department. Another department was building houses and trying to do the best it could to make their lives good lives. And so there was that contradiction. And this gave an opportunity to people like myself to kind of try and lever things over a little bit. And what we did was look, we made models of how many houses were needed, what it would cost, how many houses could be built, this kind of thing. And basically, in a sense, what we proved, it was rather similar to the cosmology. We proved that the government policy could not provide the houses that were needed with the money available. In a sense, it's a rather parallel result.
Right. And weren't you also in the same period of time becoming Quaker?
Yes. Yes, when I got back to South Africa, I was looking around in a religious sense because I'd got fairly disillusioned with the Anglican church that I'd been brought up in. And I just found that the Quakers were involved, as in England and America, elsewhere, they were always involved with issues of peace and poverty and trying to improve life. So I joined them basically in order to take part in their actual practical on-the-ground programs, and then I gradually found that their theology was extremely congenial for a scientist because it didn't involve a creed that I had to believe in. It didn't involve people telling me what I had to believe. So it was a congenial for a scientist.
Mm-hmm. I mean, did that new practice of faith also interact with this mathematical work you were doing on social issues like housing?
In a sense, it was a motivation because in terms of trying to improve the situation, you can do the short-term, medium-term, or long-term. The short-term is trying to change things on the ground quite quickly, and I got involved in that through the Quaker Service Fund, which was the local meeting was running. The policy things was trying to do things in a medium term, and I quite like to try to do things both the short-term and the medium-term.
Okay.
And then the science and religion debate, incidentally, is long-term, so there's...
You know, there's a quote... Copy this down. This is how I think the rest of us imagine scientists and philosophers might speak about religion at worst. This is actually an ethicist, philosopher Bernard Williams. You quote him in your book On the Moral Nature of Universe, and he conceded that if God existed, there might be special reasons for subscribing to morality, but concluded, unfortunately, the very concept of God is incoherent. Religion itself is incurably unintelligible. I mean, is that a kind of attitude that was familiar to you previously as a scientist, or is that a stereotype?
I would say that's a stereotype. There's a group of very vocal scientists who are very anti-religious, but they're a relative minority. Quite honestly, a very large number of scientists simply aren't interested. They're not concerned one way or the other. They don't regard it as particularly relevant.
Yeah, I mean, I think you describe the field of cosmology as something that to outsiders might seem to have to imply religious questions, but can exist very much in isolation.
I like to think of cosmology as there's two separate subjects. There's cosmology with a small c, which is physical cosmology, how galaxies came, gravity causing stars to come into existence, expansion of the universe, all of that. Cosmology with a capital C is when you bring in human interest, you talk about its implications for humanity and all of that. That's the anthropological sense in which we use. Now, effectively, all of my colleagues at work look at the first one, not the second one.
The small c.
Yep.
Quaker cosmologist George Ellis, recipient of the 2004 Templeton Prize for Research at the Intersection of Science and Religion. He said he'll devote half of the $1.4 million award to social initiatives in his native South Africa. In the late 1980s, early 90s, events in the world and in your country of South Africa in particular took a very dramatic turn. You know, I was living in Germany at that time. I had been in divided Berlin, and like everyone else, I think, believed that maybe the Berlin Wall wasn't eternal, but it would certainly never go away in my lifetime. And the change in South Africa was no less dramatic.
Correct. Yeah.
You have this wonderful phrase. You've said that what happened in South Africa confounded the calculus of reality.
Of rationality.
Of rationality. That's better. So, I'd like to get into that. I'd like to know how what happened in your country, and for you living through it, how that changed you as a person of faith and as a scientist, and how does that make you think differently about mathematical models?
I belonged to a community that was fighting the apartheid system in a non-violent way. Now, of course, there was the people who were fighting it in a violent way, the ANC and the PAC. And we were fighting it in a non-violent way, and the people I was working with were very, very principled. The temptation was to turn around and to look at the evil which was being caused. And part of what we did was making sure that the public knew about the evil. We wanted to be absolutely certain that the National Party and the government would never be able to say we didn't know what was happening. And that was part of what we were doing. So we were very, very aware of that evil. But the temptation was then to turn around and to say these are hopeless, irredeemable people. They're evil people rather than people who are causing evil acts. Mm. And the whole way that this opposition worked, which was based in the churches and in an amazing organization called the Black Sash and the Institute of Race Relations. All of these groups were working together. They were trying to do it in a way which was principled and which did not deny the humanity of the oppressors. And that's, in a sense, is where this whole thing kind of got going. And the community in which I was, which was a really extraordinary community, really was trying to fight apartheid, but not to do it in a way which demonized the government, which was causing all of this pain.
Which is very much in the spirit of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that came later.
Absolutely.
You know, this phrase, the calculus of rationality, I got it right that time. That also sounds like a scientist reflecting on world events. And then does that reflect back on your science? Or does it make you think about the limits of science?
I guess that the interesting thing is to try to see how there could be unexpected forces at work. And the rationality was pointing out to this bloodbath, and many, many people believed it would come. Many, many of my friends either left or were very tempted to leave the country because of that. I think that the interesting thing, in a sense, is the hidden underlying thing, the unexpected things were happening in the background. And while all of that opposition was taking place, it was getting worse and worse. There were kids being shot in the street. There were burning tires. There were police vehicles, the whole thing. There was also this quiet force working to try to change it. What actually changed it, I think one should say, is not the military struggle. It was the economic boycott and the sports boycott. Those kinds of things were what actually changed it. And so in a sense, what is interesting is to try from a cause and effect thing to see what are the things which really make a difference and what are the things which people think will make a difference and don't. And I think in a sense, that's part of what it's about, that there are surprises in the causality, and it's difficult to actually understand before it's happened what will be important and what won't.
And also to be thinking about what is happening that might be making a difference that we're not even paying attention to at any given moment.
Correct.
Which sort of does bring you to the idea of hope. I mean, is that is that where hope started to enter your vocabulary?
The South African situation all the time was teetering on the brink of disaster, and it's been an absolutely amazing thing through all of those years. Every time it looked worse and worse, it looked like it was going to go right over the brink. Something would pull it back and would save it, because the worse things got, the more the repression, it would always generate a counter-reaction which would pull it back again. And so hope was very difficult in many times. In fact, on one particular part of time, I did really virtually lose hope, because there was a period when the government employed vigilantes in the townships to burn down the houses, the informal houses, of about 10,000 people who were living in shanties. These were the township in which my wife was working as a doctor. And every day for 2 weeks, there was the smoke I could see from my office rising up from these burning houses. And I went out with various people, tried to talk to the police, tried to contact people in the government, tried, can't you do anything about it? But, of course, they were behind it. And so at that stage, I did, in fact, for a while lose hope because I couldn't see any way that one could change it at all. And, in fact, for a while then, I did actually lose hope and I took up a job in Italy for a while, for about 4 years. Mm. But then I couldn't stay away. I came back because there was stuff to be done.
You know, you said it would almost go to the brink and then something would happen to pull it back. Is that something that you were aware of at the time, or is it only something you can see when it's over?
I gradually became more and more aware of it, that every time it was looking just about one was really going to go over and everything would be destroyed, that somehow the forces would pull it back. And, of course, part of that, again, it's this thing in the people who were causing the oppression, that they also inside them had something which didn't really want the whole thing to get destroyed, despite everything that they had done. Mm.
Cosmologist George Ellis. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is Speaking of Faith. We're talking about the intersection of faith and science in George Ellis's thought. He has studied such lofty topics as the structure of space and time. In recent years, he's also become interested in whether the universe has an underlying moral foundation. George Ellis points to the recurring ethic of nonviolence and self-sacrifice that runs throughout the major religions and the lives of human beings who've changed the world. Figures such as Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and in Ellis's native South Africa, Nelson Mandela and Stephen Biko. As a Quaker Christian, George Ellis values a key image of the ethic of Jesus found in the New Testament. It uses a Greek word, kenosis, to describe Jesus' sacrifice of his life and his power for the freedom of others. The word kenosis means to empty oneself. Here's more of my conversation with George Ellis that took place before a live audience in Philadelphia.
So in this book you've written with a theologian, Nancy Murphy, called On the Moral Nature of the Universe, you say that one important piece of the dialogue between science and religion, and I think also what you're saying, one important piece of how we view what happens in the world and what it means or what makes a difference is ethics.
Yeah.
And you talk about the true nature of deep ethics.
Yes.
So talk about that. I think it's also interesting that, you know, coming, obviously you did have this wonderful, miraculous turn of events in South Africa, but for decades and for longer than that. I mean, you say ethics is, you feel that ethics is something that's in the universe to be discovered.
Yes.
So tell us how you can come to that.
Let me just prepare the way slightly by saying, in order to understand what I mean by that, the same is true of mathematics. Mathematicians discover the nature of mathematics despite what they want. So what I mean by that is something like the following. It was a great shock to mathematicians when they discovered that the square root of 2 was irrational. It's not something that they wanted. The number pi is irrational. That's also not something mathematicians wanted. What I'm pointing out here is that mathematics exists and is discovered. It's not invented by humans. It's something which is discovered. Therefore, in some sense, it exists in order to be discovered. The view on ethics I take is, as an ethical realist, is it's the same. The nature is sitting there in some sense waiting to be discovered. And the deep nature of ethics which we're writing about is what we call kenotic ethics. Mm-hmm. Kenosis being letting go or giving up on behalf of other people.
Right, and kenosis is a Greek word.
It's a Greek word meaning letting go or giving up. It's used in the Bible in Philippians. It's central to my understanding of Christianity. And there's a spectrum which goes through, in practical terms, from forgiveness, which is a crucial part, in which you are giving up the need for revenge, and it goes through to self-sacrifice on behalf of others, which is what Gandhi was about, Martin Luther King was about. And to me, that's the really, really deep transformative principle, which was also in the life of Christ, of course, when he sacrificed himself on behalf of others. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to say that, to me, kenosis, it's a generic principle which is much wider than just ethics. For instance, it's actually central, this emptying oneself is actually central to education and learning, because if you go into learning any subject with a preconceived notion, you can't learn. You have to empty your mind of your preconceived notion that you can see something new. In ethics, it's the key point about kenosis and is the willingness to give up, which makes way for contact with the human part of the other person. And it's a kind of moral jujitsu in that they are expecting you to react in the way that they want you to react. They are your enemy and they want you to be their enemy. And if you refuse to be their enemy, then they don't know how to handle it. As an example from our South African context, one of the people I worked with as a social worker and community worker was detained by the security police. So now he's in jail with them. He then started, because of his nature, he's an outgoing, generous kind of guy. He starts talking to the jail wardens, how are your children? How are you getting on? Do you enjoy doing what you're doing? And so all this kind of, that totally undermines what a jail is supposed to be about. Because now you are treating the person who is holding you prisoner as an equal, as a person. And you are ignoring the fact that he's the jailer and you're the prisoner. And that just changes the context.
So that would be a really gentle form of this.
That's
kenotic ethics.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then the extreme form would be a person like Nelson Mandela, the example he
yes.
set.
Yes.
Being in prison for 20 years.
Being in prison for 20 years and not letting go of the grudges, the hatred which he could have had. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, so let's just clarify. You believe that this ethos, this ethic of kenosis, in fact, is like a mathematical truth. It's sort of
yes.
built into the universe.
Yeah.
And it finds expression in I don't know, every major religious tradition I can think of in some form.
Correct.
Humility, self-sacrifice, yeah. serving others.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's very counterintuitive to the way, I don't know, than today's newspaper would tell us the world works.
Yeah. It's counterintuitive because the way it works is it transforms the context. In the real conflict situations, the kind of thing which Gandhi was involved with, where he was trying to free India from the British oppressors, he trained his followers to accept suffering, not to retaliate. And by doing so, he reached into the hearts of the British oppressors. But after a while, the pain is incredible at that deep level. The pain is incredible. The training is incredible. Gandhi spent about 15 years studying and thinking before he did it. So did Martin Luther King.
The pain of what?
Of doing what, in a sense, is incredibly unnatural, of being willing to sacrifice, of being willing to, in that case, to be beaten up, just as they were, to be beaten up and not to retaliate. It requires incredible courage, devotion, dedication in that extreme kind of form. The life of Christ, of course, is the ultimate kind of example.
I think I want to ask you, is this something that has to do with you as a person of faith more than a scientist, or does this also flow into this idea of this ethic that's embedded in the universe? Does this also affect you as a cosmologist or the way you approach the field of cosmology?
It's this cosmology with the small c and the big c.
This is the cosmology with a big c?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
From the cosmology with the big c, it immediately gives one for a route into, in effect, arguing for the existence of God, if you like, from the way that the whole thing is constructed. From
okay.
the small c, it's, as a scientist, I work as a scientist, and this just doesn't enter into it.
Mm-hmm.
As a cosmologist in the big C, that is trying to understand the big pattern, the way humanity relates to the universe, it's a central issue.
You also talk about the limits of science
yeah.
and about how ethics and human consciousness and human emotion, although they often get bracketed out
yeah.
as illogical and not a part of science, in fact are always causing things to happen,
yeah.
and in some sense driving the physical universe and all the things that science can study. Is that fair?
There were several kind of things. Do you want to pursue the limits to science, or do you want to pursue...
Whichever one you want to go. Or we can do them in order, of your choice.
I think it's terribly important in terms of looking at science to understand it's got these incredible achievements, and I love science, I love the way it works, but it has these limits, and the limits which I think it's really important to understand is science says nothing about ethics or aesthetics or meaning or metaphysics, all of these areas. And you immediately get told by some people, look, this is just the old God of the gaps thing, and, this is discredited. It's not the God of the gaps, it's the God of the boundaries.
Which is that God is in what we can't understand or work with in science. Yeah.
But the point about the God of the gaps argument is saying, look, that's a gap which will be filled in by science. But
right.
the point about this is that there are boundaries to what science can handle, and science will never, ever get into those areas. And that's crucially important. And the one which is important is ethics. So let's go back to the ethics. Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot of people out there trying to say, well, ethics is understood by science through sociobiology. There's another lot of social scientists saying ethics is understood through sociology and psychology and anthropology and so on. And they are just profoundly mistaken when they say that for a whole host of reasons. And perhaps we don't want to get technical about this, but the simple way to see how mistaken they are is to ask the following question to a scientist who says, look, science can comprehend ethics. We can use science as a basis for ethics. So fine, mm-hmm. we say, fine, tell us what science says we should do in Iraq today.
Okay.
Then you get this deafening silence because science is totally unable to say anything about that. And the reason is there are no experiments in science to do with what is good and what is bad. There are no scientific units for good and bad. There's no experiment. It's just outside the scope of science, not only now, but forever. It never, ever will be within the bound of science.
So what is good and what is bad, but also just what human beings do,
yeah.
which is essentially what happens in the world.
Yeah.
Cosmologist George Ellis of the University of Cape Town. After a short break, more of our conversation and George Ellis's response to questions from a studio audience. You'll hear more about his idea that ethical truths and principles are built into the universe, much like mathematics. On our website, there are background and resources for further exploration of the ideas George Ellis presents. That's speakingoffaith.org. While you're there, please sign up for our weekly email newsletter. That's where I offer reflections and book recommendations for each week's program. Also at speakingoffaith.org, we have an online survey. We're hoping for your comments and suggestions. I'm Krista Tippett. Stay with us.
Audio cassettes and transcripts are available by calling 1-800-777-TEXT or by visiting our website at speakingoffaith.org. Speaking of Faith is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. Ulele baba baba ngixolela ngonile bo baba ngixolela wo mina ngonile bo baba ngixolela wo ngonile bo baba ngixolela 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 Welcome back to Speaking of Faith, conversation about belief, meaning, ethics, and ideas. I'm Krista Tippett.
Each week, we take a different theme, exploring how religious ideas shape and are informed by human experience. Today, Science and Hope with 2004 Templeton Prize winner George Ellis. As a cosmologist, George Ellis has explored the nature of space and time, including such questions as whether the universe had a beginning. He's also interested in how human behavior affects the physical universe. He believes that the peaceful end of apartheid in his native South Africa was an event that, in his words, defied the calculus of rationality. Through his social activism in South Africa, his Quaker faith, and his scientific research, Ellis has concluded that there are deep ethical truths, an ethical compass built into the physical universe. He calls it a kenotic ethic, referring to a New Testament Greek word describing the ethic of Jesus. At the extreme end, kenosis implies sacrificing one's life. In daily life, Ellis says, it is the basic work of relationship and community, of balancing self-interest with the good of others. My conversation with George Ellis was recorded before a live audience at WHYY in Philadelphia, and he also responded to questions from the audience. Speaking of Faith's executive producer, Bill Buesenberg, moderated that exchange.
Why is the kenotic ethic inherent in the structure of the universe? Where does it come from?
Okay. Let me immediately say that there is no scientific proof of this kind of statement. This is a, like everything else to do with religion, this is a faith statement, and I can't prove it's right, but I can give you arguments that it's right. Where does it come from? At one level, the answer is, comes from the nature of God. It's what is evidenced for us by all the major religious traditions. And you mentioned this, but I really want to emphasize this. And Sir John Templeton has written about this. This, what Sir John Templeton calls agape love, unconditional love, it is in all the major religious traditions. And I particularly, from my own experience, was talking about this in Berkeley a while ago at the Science and Spiritual Quest. And I finished talking, and a man rushed up to me with great excitement and said, "Fantastic talk, I really enjoyed that." He says, "You spoke like a Muslim." and he was the director of the Muslim Center in London. And I think that's really important to understand in the present day, that the true deep understanding of the Muslim faith incorporates this idea. I, in turn, in London, was at the State of the World meeting, and I heard Professor Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi of Great Britain, talking about this. Mm. And he is an absolutely marvelous person who talked in exactly the same kind of way. So I had fun going up to him afterwards. I said, "Professor Sacks, you talked like a Quaker." And he looked at me and he said, "I will choose to take that as a compliment." And the evidence that it is something more than just what some people invent is the fact that it is discovered independently by all the great religious traditions.
So this is the nature of God, this way of being, this kenosis, this ethic, and it's embedded in the universe as an expression of that is embedded in the universe.
This is why I introduced this thing about mathematics. We haven't got a clue in what way mathematics is embedded there, but it is there in some platonic space waiting to discover. We actually haven't got a clue how the laws of physics are embedded in the universe. We know they're there. We know they're effective. Mm-hmm. We don't know how they are embedded. Okay. So it's important to understand we don't understand those either. In the same way, I envisage ethics as being a universal thing, which is applicable. It is there because of the nature of God. It is something we discover and don't invent now. That's why I made that point about mathematics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it is discovered to be the same by all these religious traditions. So I'm confident of the following. If we were to one day make contact with people in Alpha Centauri...
These are people in other galaxies.
Yes.
Life in other...
Yeah.
Yes.
We would start talking with them about mathematics because we're confident that they will have the same understanding of mathematics as we do. If we got on to talk to them about ethics, I'm confident we would find that they also had discovered kenotic ethics in the nature of the universe. Mm.
We have a questioner who wants to know, what is the evidence that ethics, like math, is in the universe waiting to be discovered?
The evidence is firstly in seeing that all these other religious traditions have come to the same conclusion. But the deep evidence is the same in all faith. It is by beginning to comprehend the deep nature of this transforming power. And if you see the deepness and the quality of transformation that is possible through this, and if you really ask me to pursue it, then it is the life of Christ which is the example. Giving up life in order that those that persecuted him would have freedom. That is what it is about. And in the end, it is self-authenticating. There is actually no other way of saying it. It is something you either see or you don't see. There is no proof. It's something you recognize or you don't recognize.
I also hear you describing it as a model which replicates itself, which yes. replicated itself in South Africa.
Yeah.
Have you also had experiences in your life that are more personal and not as dramatic, of living this way, this counterintuitive way?
Not dramatic. My life has been very undramatic in small ways.
Well, that's how, in small ways is how most of us would have a chance to do this, I think.
Yeah. In a sense, it's a principle which can be applied all the time. I've never done anything dramatic about sort of offering up my life on behalf of others and so on. But it's a kind of generic principle which underlies all of community living, being willing to, just step back a little bit in order that there's room for the community to function. Mm. I can't claim any dramatic example in my own life, but I'm absolutely convinced of the power of the idea from thinking about it, seeing it. There's an entire range through, and very, very much experiencing it in the sense of trying with others to devise strategies in which one was trying to get at the fact that while the Nationalist Party was engaged in all of this thing, nevertheless, they didn't want to think that they were behaving in that way. There was this kind of internal contradiction, and so one could try to strengthen the good by pointing out ways that they could behave better, by trying to make them see that what they were doing was causing pain, was causing damage, was killing people and so on. You can't make that contact if you have consigned them to the devil category.
So it's not just about how you are behaving, it's also at the same time about how you are seeing and experiencing the person who is your enemy.
Absolutely, yes, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Who is making you suffer.
Yeah.
Given your path of peaceful resistance, do you have any advice for those in conflict in our schools, our boardrooms, and the military? Is there a path of thought to use as we evaluate confrontational situations in everyday life?
Well, something I've said in other places, I really want to say here, I think our biggest enemy in all of this is Hollywood. If you turn on the television, within 10 minutes, and absolutely all without exception, you will find the cinema, TV is teaching people to... The way to solve problems is to kill people. And that is a message which is broadcast to the black people in the townships of my country who are sitting there. It is the role model which is offered to them. And what we've got to do is try to make available the alternative models where children learn from the smallest ages to the adults that there are other ways to solve this, that there are peaceful solutions, there are ways in which you sit down and try and talk with people. You don't pull out a gun and shoot them, which is what Hollywood is teaching people daily, 24 hours a day. And I really think that is one of the major problems we have at this time. I'm not sure what one does about that.
Do you know of projects or, what do you have something in mind? How do we create these models, these other kinds of images?
Well, one of the projects I'm involved with in Cape Town is the Quaker Peace Center, and we run a schools education program. There's a spectrum, and at the simple spectrum, it is kind of conflict resolution techniques, getting to yes, mediation, all that kind of sort of stuff. But I think it's really important to try to take it further. The self-sacrifice is the far end, the really difficult end, but the part which everybody can reach, which is difficult, but it can be reached, is the issue of forgiveness and the realization of the damage that resentments cause. The fact that you can let go of resentments and forgive and transform the situation by doing that. There's a very interesting phrase that comes in that. You cannot change the facts of the past, but you can change the meaning of the past by reevaluating it. And I think it is possible and easy in schools to teach, relatively easy, the sort of the simple skills of conflict resolution, listening to the other, and that trying to be in their sandals, all that kind of sort of stuff. I think it is possible at the school level to go through to trying to teach people about forgiveness. I think the far end is more difficult.
The problem is that Hollywood is so compelling. It's exciting. I mean, I think the challenge is, how do we come up with images that are that captivating? And where do we do that?
There are examples, like, for instance, the film of Gandhi's life, for instance, was putting that other kind of view. Let me make a contentious statement here. I haven't seen the Mel Gibson film, but as I understand it, he does not represent this...
Kenosis.
Kenosis, yeah.
Quaker cosmologist George Ellis responding to audience questions during a live taping of Speaking of Faith in Philadelphia. I'm Krista Tippett. We're exploring how scientific and religious ideas converge in George Ellis's thought. He's been speaking about the deep universal ethic of kenosis, or self-giving, which he believes is built into the cosmos. A member of the audience asked how this ethic might be applied in a situation like the current U.S. involvement in Iraq.
I want to take just a little bit of time about this because this is very important. Let me first step back to an example of the historical kenosis, which was crucially important. It's the difference between the end of the First World War and the end of the Second World War. The end of the First World War was the Treaty of Versailles, which was a vengeful treaty in which there was absolutely no kenosis. It set up a situation in which vengeance was enacted on the German people, and one can argue whether or not that was a just thing to do, but it put the situations in place which let Hitler gain his power, and it put the German people in a place which guaranteed that the Second World War would take place, and that is shown in many of the studies of the beginning of the Second World War. The lesson was learnt, and at the end of the Second World War, although the leaders were held to account and some of them executed, the population at large of Germany was not treated in the same way as the end of the First World War. Instead, there was the Marshall Plan, which was a giving up. It was a giving to the German people who had caused this immense destruction, and it is that which put in place the basis of peace in Europe for the next 50 years. And I think that is a really practical example of the kind of thing I'm talking about. Now, I'm going to read something which I told you I would read about. In relation to Iraq, I want to read to you. When I got the prize, I got a lot of email and so on, and some of it's very interesting. This is from a man called David Christie. He says as follows. In 1967, I was a young officer in a Scottish battalion engaged in peacekeeping duties in Aden Town in what is now Yemen. The situation was similar to Iraq, with people being killed every day. As always, those who suffered the most were the innocent local people. Not only were we tough, but we had the power to pretty well destroy the whole town had we wished. This is the British Army. But we had a commanding officer who understood how to make peace, and he led us to do something very unusual, not to react when we were attacked. Only if we were 100% certain that a particular person had thrown a grenade or fired a shot at us were we allowed to fire. During our tour of duty, we had 102 grenades thrown at us, and in response, the battalion fired the grand total of 2 shots, killing 1 grenade thrower. The cost to us was over 100 of our own men wounded, and, surely by the grace of God, only 1 killed. When they threw rocks at us, we stood fast. When they threw grenades, we hit the deck, and after the explosions, we got to our feet and stood fast. We did not react in anger or indiscriminately. This was not the anticipated reaction. Slowly, very slowly, the local people began to trust us and made it clear to the local terrorists that they were not welcome in their area. At one stage, neighboring battalions were having a torrid time with attacks. We were playing soccer with the locals. We had, in fact, brought peace to the area at the cost of our own blood. How had this been achieved? Principally because we were led by a man whom every soldier in the battalion knew would die for him if required. Each soldier in turn came to be prepared to sacrifice himself for such a man. Many people may sneer that we were merely obeying orders, but this was not the case. Our commanding officer was more highly regarded by his soldiers than the general, one might almost say loved. So gradually the heart of the peacemaker began to grow in a man and determination to succeed whatever the cost. Probably most of the soldiers, like myself, only realized years afterwards what had been achieved. That is kenosis. In action, in a strange situation, an army armed to the teeth, but acting in a way in which they were sacrificing because they were wounded and they didn't take revenge unless they were 100% certain what they were doing.
This is an example, I think, of the question, how do you prove this? You prove it by telling stories, right?
Yeah.
You point at it when you see it.
Yes. And I don't know if Vivi Raman is here, my friend Vivi Raman. In relation to September 11th event, he has said the following. The situation would have been totally different if the following had happened. If the President of the United States, once it was established Al-Qaeda was responsible, had said, I do not understand why you did this. I want to meet with you in some neutral country so that you can tell me why you acted in the way you did. If that had been what had happened, it would have been exactly not the reaction which they had expected. It would have been totally the opposite of what they had thought. I'm not saying it would have changed things, but it would at least have had a chance of producing a totally different outcome.
And it flies so much in the face of, the very notion of having power, which, you know, and I don't even mean that as anything that is morally loaded one way or the other, because it is about being strong.
It's about being
resolute.
It's about the nature of power.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the power of transformation instead of the power of destruction.
You know, I love something that's implied in what you're describing, of there is this expression of the nature of the creator of the universe, which shows itself in this ethic, which we can point to in many places and many times, and that religious traditions have discovered that and articulated it. Rather than thinking about religious people as championing something which doesn't sound efficacious, sort of flies in the face of the world's logic, it's religious traditions as explorers and, in a sense, practitioners of this science of ethics.
Well, one of the words which, to me, is a mark of deep religion is paradox. G.K. Chesterton wrote about paradox.
Yeah.
And often the true nature of things is paradoxical. And the Christian paradox is that the true nature of power is in weakness and suffering. That is the true nature of power. And it is transformative. And the point about, if you talk about security, the underlying question is, what's the true nature of security? And the answer is very simple. You are secure if you have no enemies. That's where security lies. So how do you change enemies into friends is the true question which underlies true security.
Mm. Before we end, that's a wonderful place to end. I want to ask you a completely self-indulgent question. I'm slightly emboldened in asking this question because one of the quotable things that Einstein said is that he started asking all the important questions that he pursued the rest of his life when he was a 3-year-old, because he said young children are asking the big questions. Where did we come from and what does it mean? So my question was, if God created the world, who created God?
Ah, yes.
How do you, because you're telling me that you also, I believe you're telling me, you've concluded that there is a God and there can be a God in your cosmology, but how do you think your way into that question?
It's a very valid question, and it's one for which we haven't got any clue to the answer. But that is the same for every attempt to understand the foundations of the universe. Science runs into that and religions runs into that. My colleagues are producing theories of what they call creation of the universe out of nothing. But when you probe them, you find they're not producing theories of creation of the universe out of nothing. They're assuming a huge machinery of quantum field theory and fields and particles and interactions which generates the universe. It's not creation of the universe
out of nothing. Which had to come from somewhere.
Yeah, it had to come from somewhere else. And in the end, we run into a metaphysical blank, whether you pursue it scientifically or religiously, and you simply have to give up in wonder and awe and say, I don't know the answer, and it's just marvelous what the way things are.
Okay, that's your last word. George Ellis, thank you so much. Congratulations on the Templeton Prize. George Ellis is professor of applied mathematics at the University of Cape Town and recipient of the $1.4 million Templeton Prize for Progress Towards Research or Discoveries About Spiritual Realities. His books include On the Moral Nature of the Universe, Cosmology, Theology, and Ethics. At our website, speakingoffaith.org, you'll find web-only audio of additional questions George Ellis took from our Philadelphia audience, and you'll find background on all of his ideas. While you're there, we'd love to hear your thoughts, and we'd also like your input on our online survey of listener reactions and suggestions. Finally, please sign up at speakingoffaith.org for our weekly email newsletter. That's where you'll learn about upcoming topics and the ideas that go into the creation of our shows. This program was produced by Kate Moose and Mitch Hanley. Our web producer is Trent Gillis. We have assistance from Judy Stone Nunnally. Special thanks for this program go to Christine Dempsey, Pamela Thompson, Julia Loving, John Knapp, Julian Hertzfeld, and Kay Kinsey. The managing producer of Speaking of Faith is Marja Struschko. Our executive producer is Bill Buesenberg, and I'm Krista Tippett. Please join us again next week.
Speaking of Faith is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support is provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life to explore how religion shapes ideas and institutions, pewforum.org. The George Family Foundation, funding innovative ideas in integrative medicine, education, and spirituality in everyday life. And the John Templeton Foundation, exploring the creative interface between science and religion. Audio cassettes and transcripts are available by calling 1-800-777-TEXT or by visiting our website at speakingoffaith.org. This program is a production of Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.